This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is the city's largest public employee union. We have 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m., and we rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We are also now available as a podcast on iTunes. Simply go to the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad and search for DC 37 State of the Union. DC 37 members, there are now more ways to stay in touch with your union. You can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can always check out our website, www.dc37.net. And every month, keep a lookout for your union newspaper, the Public Employee Press, in your mailbox. Tonight, we have a special guest, New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer. He joins us to discuss why the city's five public employee pension systems recently voted to divest from companies that run private prisons. So joining us now by phone, New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer. Welcome to the show.
It's great, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
This was a big deal. Can you take a step back and explain to us, tell us about private companies that run prisons?
Sure. Well, look, private prisons are morally bankrupt, and they're financially risky. This is an industry that makes money by literally putting people in cages. And this industry wants Donald Trump to succeed more than anything else. They have a financial interest in deporting our neighbors, many who are held in these facilities. They want to go back to the failed criminal justice policies of the past. Across America, there's 126,000 inmates in roughly 130 private prisons. And we've looked at these private prisons. They have the highest rate of security and safety incidents. They put nonviolent inmates in solitary confinement just to deal with overcrowding. And they lack appropriate medical care because it eats into their profits. One California private prison saw three inmates die in 3 months. And 65% of ICE detainees are imprisoned in these private prisons.
Now, these companies boomed at some point, the idea of incarcerating people as a business became popular. How did that happen? Do we know how that was? Was that about skyrocketing crime rates in the at the beginning of the century?
This was always politics, right? The prison industrial complex has long been active in our state. I remember being a young assemblyman when you and I were starting out, and we would fight in Albany to stop these Republican senators from getting an appropriation to build a prison in their district.
Right.
Because they wanted the prison not to reduce crime. They wanted the prison to create economic development in their upstate communities. Think about just how jaded that is. They took mostly black and brown kids, shipped them upstate, and that created economic development. Those of us on the progressive side in Albany said, wait a minute, we don't want to put our children in these prisons upstate. We want to create opportunity for them to keep them out of prison. Now, 20 years later, we realize the prison expansion was a mess and it didn't work. And now the same strategy has now become a corporate strategy. People invest in private prisons, not to reduce crime, not to make society safer, but they want private prisons so they can make money off mass incarceration. That is why we in the pension fund, myself, Henry Garrido, District Council 37, our other trustees, we said, no mas, it's enough. We pulled $48 million out. We are the first public pension fund in America to do this. I'm now working nationally to make the case to other pension funds, other controllers and treasurers, that this is our moment to send a clear message to Donald Trump that we are not going to put people in harm's way so that a few wealthy people can make money off the criminal justice system.
You know, we talk a lot on this show, obviously, because it's the DC 37 show. We talk a lot about the downside of privatizing public services. And nowhere does it seem clearer. We also talk about the kinds of crazy deals that often get cut between private companies and government, so that I believe it's true that some of these private prisons have deals where if the prison population goes below a certain percentage, they actually the governments actually have to pay a penalty, so that there's like a guaranteed incarceration rate.
Right. So that's why we don't have programs that keep kids out of harm's way. But here's the thing, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm responsible for the retirement security of 700,000 New Yorkers, people who are DC 37 employees, teachers, firefighters, city workers all over the city. So I take that responsibility very seriously. And the reason that we could pull out of private prison is because we did the math, we did the work, and we found that there would be no harm to our pension fund if we did divest. And in fact, I'm so concerned about the reputational harm that the pension fund could come into play, because I don't see where these pension fund with these private prisons are going to do anything but cause real havoc in our society.
And you're saying that the private prisons see in these difficult times in which we live, and in this climate of fear about immigration and immigrant rights and the criminalization of that the connection between detaining immigrants and good business, big business for these companies, that there's a connection there, and that there is a strategy, perhaps. Maybe not people sitting down directly and saying, okay, we're going to lock them up and then you're going to get this contract. But it is, they go hand in hand with each other, this idea, well, right?
Yes. But and when you look at what's happening within those prison walls, lack of medical care, people dying in these prisons, immigrants being detained, going to these private prisons, this causes a reputational risk if you invest in these prisons. If Donald Trump has his way, he wants to expand these prisons. That means more overcrowding. That could portend disaster, and that could weaken anyone's financial investment. So I believe by getting out of this, getting out of private prisons, we protect our pension fund, and we also send a loud message that mass incarceration should not be profit-driven. The criminal justice system should not be about who makes money and who loses money. And I think we sent that message. I'm very proud of the trustees that worked on this. Henry Garrido was at the forefront of this effort. And I want to just thank DC 37 because we work very closely together to meet the needs and the challenges of our pension fund.
We're talking with New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer. Scott, I'm curious, when we make a decision like this and when we do something like this, what is the national implication in terms of what other pension systems do? And are they looking to us? What kind of relationships do we have, across the country that when something like this happens, that there is an echo effect?
It's a very good question. You know, we're the fourth largest pension fund in America. We're the 14th largest in the world. We're $179 billion strong. When I became controller, we started what's called the Boardroom Accountability Project. For the first time, our pension fund worked with pension funds around the country, looking at the companies we invest in, demanding that they had more diversity on their corporate boards, a lot more diversity on their corporate boards. We looked at the CEOs of companies that were making so much money at the expense of share owners like pension funds. We challenged corporate America on the outrageous fees they were charging to invest our money. So we have been very much connected to the treasurers and controllers around the country, working together, united, holding corporations accountable. And we do this work, again, because it's about the city worker, the person who worked 20, 30 years to make our city better and in exchange would get a retirement security. And that's what I think about every day when we do this national work. How is it going to work for the retirees I represent? And that is something that's very satisfying, but we've been very successful in sort of changing the dynamic now, becoming, you know, the gold standard in terms of these issues.
You know, we're going to be talking later in the show about this difficult week, certainly with the shooting at the playground yesterday in the baseball field yesterday in Washington. And there's been a lot of talk in the last 24 hours about perhaps this changes the divisive discourse and the tone of the conversations that we've been having in Washington, D.C. And I'm wondering, just I couldn't let you go without asking you what you think, good or bad, will come out of what happened earlier in this week.
Well, look, this is a terrible tragedy. And at the risk of sounding divisive, I think Donald Trump came into this election attacking people, creating a lot of this hatred that we've never seen in this country, especially towards immigrants and people who struggle in this country. But putting that aside for a second, there should be no tolerance for what amounts to, you know, political assassination. You know, lost in that whole tragedy yesterday was there was a 10-year-old boy, the son of a congressman, who was on that ball field. And it didn't get a lot of play, but I noticed this because I'm an older guy with two young kids.
Yeah, sure.
And so the first thing I zeroed in on, you know, oh my God, there's a 10-year-old on that baseball field.
Right.
And so this is very real, and this is something that we have to all take responsibility in making sure we don't go too far. It is appropriate and right to challenge Donald Trump because his policies are not good for this country. But when something like that happens yesterday, it reminds us that we're still, you know, Americans. We still all want what's good for our families. And, you know, what happened yesterday was sickening. It tears at our democracy.
But do you think that, I mean, listen, I don't want to sound jaded by the fact that we've had far too many of these types of events. But when it happens in Washington and it happens to our lawmakers, I mean, I thought this was going to change. I thought there was going to be a real change in the tone of the conversation when Gabby Giffords got shot. And I thought that folks were going to rally around the fact that this is totally unacceptable for elected officials to be targets. Do you think that perhaps because of the way it happened and where it happened, that maybe there could be a change, that we could be?
You know, I always want to believe that the glass is half full. But we've had Sandy Hook, we've had Gabby Giffords, we've had some 1,300 mass shootings in this country in a very short period of time. As long as you allow guns to flow to the people who shouldn't have them, we're always going to be swimming upstream. And we need strong gun control laws. You know, the terrorist or the person who wants to do harm, you know, Democrat, Republican, sure, lawmakers, we don't want them targeted. But what about the children in classrooms across America at our colleges? I mean, at some point, this government has got to wake up and realize that these guns should not be in the hands of people who are not law enforcement or security, plain and simple. And until that day comes, I just fear that this is becoming so commonplace in society, we're almost going to expect these things to happen as a way of life. I hope we never get to that point. And I'm going to do everything I can to speak truth to power on these issues.
Scott Stringer is the comptroller of the city of New York. And thank you very much for taking the time. And I look forward to talking to you again, sir.
Chris, I've always wanted to be on your show. Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. My next guest is Dan Janison, columnist for Newsday. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm okay. We just got through talking with the comptroller of the city of New York, and I was asking him about his thoughts on the nature of the discourse moving forward in Washington after lawmakers are shot at and shot. And you cover the national scene, and I'm calling you to say, what do you think is going on in Washington? What do you think happens next now after this very difficult week?
Well, a couple of things to remember. There has always been political violence in this country.
Right.
And we're all as a nation experiencing it differently because of the technology, rapid communication. It was rather remarkable yesterday, which was when Representative Scalise was shot and the others. What I found remarkable was that it happened at 7 a.m. And by noon, we had already identified the person as a Bernie Sanders fan.
Right.
Gotten background on who Scalise and the rest of them were. Heard statements from President Trump and Senator Sanders, and started to debate everything again from Gabby Giffords to gun control.
Right.
All by noon.
No, that's
a 5 hour. It was like, so if you slept in, it's almost as if you missed this entire drama. And that's just by way of remarking it, how the news cycle works now.
I'm still not, is it clear? Because at some point, and of course there was all this confusion because everything's being crushed into a 5 hour period. But there seemed to me at some point to be some disagreement as to whether or not this man actually did work as a volunteer for Bernie Sanders. Do we know that to be a fact now? Because yesterday, although Sanders wanted to...
Right, he said, I have heard the allegations that... the last I read was something about a director in Iowa confirming that he was one of many, many volunteers. He was hanging around the D.C. area in recent weeks.
Right.
He had closed his business in Illinois. There's still a lot to be filled in as to who he was and what he was up to.
And we should point out to listeners, as I've done in the past, that this show is recorded on Thursday
right.
mornings and it airs on Sunday nights. So whatever happens in the day, in the time after Thursday morning and the world changes, as you just pointed out,
right.
how much happens from 7 a.m. to noon. But there is well, and this will take us off into a different direction about how much of that coverage that happens in 5 hours can possibly be accurate, or, you know, have we lost some of the accuracy in with all that?
Well, that's a good point. Waiting for the facts to come in is not in fashion.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
And waiting for the results of an investigation is not in fashion.
But this situation, again, we've seen this so often. There does seem to be, and there was a freshman congressman talking about how the freshman class is really feeling as if, and has felt as if for some time, that there needs to be a different way of discussing the issues, almost as if they shared the disgust that the rest of us have been experiencing about the kind of conversations and the kind of debate that's taking place in Washington, D.C. You know, we take this moment and we say, this is an opportunity for change. I'm just wondering what you're thinking about, because I read your piece, I guess it's this morning, where there was a litany of whatabouts. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, the conversation starts with there's too much anti-Trump rhetoric on the left, and then the answer is what? What about Gabrielle Giffords, who was shot by, you know, after a lot of anti-democratic rhetoric on the right, and the tone setting, and what about Black Lives Matter? What about Trump standing there and say and making cute references to the Second Amendment and Hillary Clinton at one of his more boisterous rallies, and calling certain members of the press or all members of the press enemies of the people and pointing to them? His it's true.
Absolutely.
His rhetoric has been like no other when it comes to reaching for violent references.
Well, you know, we try and on this program, we have tried to point out that we have tried to stick to the policies of Donald Trump and how they are, you know, can be harmful to working families, union members. But it's very hard to stay away from his rhetoric. And then he always throws this stuff back at people just when you think, OK, here's a moment where the president is acting, quote unquote, presidential.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then we all get.
Which he did.
Yes. But now today, I don't know what he has said today, and I don't know what he's going to say tomorrow.
Today we're back on Twitter, witch hunt, blah, 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 blah.
How is it? What do we think about, and I know that, you know, where we are now with this ongoing drama? As a longtime reporter, as a longtime observer, how different is this? Because you mentioned political violence, and over the years, I mean, I remember as a kid that time period where we interrupt this program, and to be, you know, 10 years old, and to hear we interrupt this program, and a Kennedy was shot, or a Martin Luther King was shot, it made you not want those words, you know, create a whole bunch of anxiety just because you didn't know what was coming next.
Right. You see bulletin on the screen and you're saying who got assassinated.
Right. But now we're in a different time. Everything's happening more quickly, and there are more ways of getting information or misinformation. And I'm just wondering, as an observer, how unique a time is this?
It's like no other. You know, it's like they say that the use of social media and use of iPhones is actually changing the wiring of our brains.
Yes.
I mean, this is a huge revolution. Huge, Y-U-G-E. When you talk about the president, you're talking about the first president to really exist, I guess, in the separate reality of mass communication, where the points don't count and the facts don't matter, and it's sort of like the entire country has to kind of find a way to work around him.
And if you were inclined to support him beforehand, you want to find a way to support him through all this
mess.
Yes. And if you were opposed to him before, you want to use it against him. But to Lil,
absolutely.
But let's go. Let's talk about the Sessions testimony earlier in the week. I'm not sure I get what the get is, and I'm hoping that you can maybe. I don't know. After the, you know, he was on the testified for a few hours, and now we've got Mueller.
He ran through an obstacle course. We didn't learn anything tremendously new. A couple of important points. He confirmed that Comey, former FBI director, was fired. Did express concern about leaving him. Comey in the room with the president, and there was nothing big out of that very bombshell Comey testimony that Sessions denied. What he did do was say, you know, it's a detestable lie to say that I was involved in things. And one of the Republican senators, Cotton, linked that to something Comey had said. But there wasn't an outright, no, he's a liar,
right,
coming from Sessions. So devoid of that, he was asked a lot of questions that he couldn't or wouldn't answer. And basically it was like he was driving, he was staying in his bureaucratic lane. He didn't drive off to hit either Trump's critics or to be a Trump critic. He stayed right in the center of the lane, and so it was an exercise in, you know, much of the same that you've seen. But it's important that he confirmed Comey's testimony, and it's also important that he denied any collusion, because collusion between the Republican campaign, which he was involved in, and anything to do with the Russians. We still don't have anything there yet.
No.
I mean, when the Republicans protest that there was no collusion, well, they can say that right now because it's because we don't, there are no indications that there was a systematic contact. However, you take a step back and common sense tells you that these guys and Putin were doing certain things and saying certain things that were anti-Clinton and pro-Trump. And then you add to that that Trump, who denounces anybody and anything at any given time, has never said a negative word about Russians or Russian interference or acknowledged any role in the election. That is extremely odd.
Yeah, it is. And unfortunately, I'm running out of time. But
okay.
But the point is, at this point in time, we still don't know what it is.
That's right.
And there are many more miles to go in this. Dan Janison is a columnist for Newsday and always one of the smartest guys in the room. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
That's just about all the time we have for this evening. I want to thank our guests, Controller Scott Stringer, Newsday reporter Dan Janison. This is State of the Union. If you have any comments about anything that you heard on this show, remember it's stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.